From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, foreign policy contributor Art Sear talks about new allegations against Paul Manafort, a proposed Brexit deal, and chaos on the U.S.-Mexican border.
Later, a recent documentary chronicles the intriguing family dynamics at work in a Milwaukee Chinese restaurant.
Chinese culture behind this is really interesting because the father, Mr. Chen, he wanted to have his family reunion or being together forever. But his son, he want to go away. So this contradiction is really interesting.
And Milwaukee poet John Cady's new collection spans 50 years of writing, a time in which he says the work of poets has changed a lot.
It's really become more a kind of career with benefits that you aspire to. Whereas no one I knew really ever thought of making a living out of writing poetry. It's something they wanted to do for its own sake.
Lake Effect is next, after the news.
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. In case you thought the U.S. had cornered the market on loud partisan discourse, the British Parliament should put those thoughts to rest. There has been no shortage of vociferous debate since Prime Minister Theresa May unveiled her plan to move forward with the process of leaving the European Union, or Brexit.
Our foreign policy contributor is Art Sear of Carthage College, and we're going to talk Brexit in just a few minutes, but there is other news on the political intrigue front that we should get to first. Nice to see you again, Art Sear.
Well, always nice to be here, Mitch. Thank you for the invitation.
So I wanted to start with this report that just literally came out within a few minutes before we started recording this conversation, that Paul Manafort, former consultant to President Trump, reportedly met secretly, or not so secretly anymore, with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange several times at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. It was first reported in the Guardian newspaper, and as we're talking, it has not been corroborated. But if it's accurate, and the two did meet in the spring of 2016, it seems like it would be of significant interest to Robert Mueller and his team.
Yes, indeed. Let's see how the story unfolds. It's certainly an interesting one, and The Guardian is a cutting-edge source that is not always reliable, but certainly is interesting. It would, if it plays out as real news, tie Mr. Manafort more directly to the Trump campaign and the president than has been the case. He's obviously been convicted in a high-profile trial and another plea bargain arrangement. But the charges on which he's been convicted have been around for many years, and the feds left him alone. They were not tied directly to President Trump. So let's see how this more current story unfolds. You're right to bring it up.
Right. And of course, the real issue throughout the course of the Mueller investigation has been at what point would this contact between the Russians and the Trump administration have happened? And how would it, you know, how would this leak of documents potentially be tied to the administration? If this proves to be the case, it would certainly add a little bit more to the narrative.
It would add to the narrative. And like I say, let's see how the story unfolds. Thank you very much for bringing it up. It's the subject generally is one of endless speculation, including in serious media. And let's see what actual facts emerge.
So I would imagine there will be plenty more shoes to drop as that story moves along. But let's shift to the shoes that are dropping in Europe as we are speaking, as the Brexit deal is under consideration in the UK. It was a couple of weeks ago that British Prime Minister Theresa May unveiled the nearly 600-page document that would shape how Great Britain will or would leave the European Union. What are the major points to understanding how that plan would work?
Well, the main thing is that it's complicated, and it will keep lawyers and scholars and media people and politician staffers and those politicians who actually do their own reading. It will keep people very busy. I think the main point is that of necessity, and that's reality imposing itself on all the rhetoric, Britain will remain in the customs union of the European Union. The vast bulk of British trade, as well as investment, including tangible, durable products. They're a more global economy in terms of services, but they're heavily concentrated in Europe, and it's really essential for the strength and continued growth of the British economy that they not face a lot of new barriers. and going into Europe.
It almost makes it feel like a non-Brexit Brexit.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I believe the prime minister has been struggling quite courageously and with great determination to try to accommodate her own and her party's ideological commitment, that is the Conservatives' current ideological commitment to getting out of the European Union, to part of the legacy of Margaret Thatcher, trying to reconcile that with the reality that they have to stay involved with Europe. They're in no position to be an isolated nation. They don't have the natural resources of the United States or many other countries, and they have to stay involved. A second main point is security regarding the complicated area of Northern Ireland, which is part of the United Kingdom, part of larger Britain, but not in the British Isles, directly in Ireland, and the very vexed border between small Protestant Northern Ireland, Protestants the majority population, and Catholic Southern Ireland, as many of our listeners will know, has been a source of great violence historically for several hundred years. The British government, and especially the British military, deserve great credit for bringing about a peace agreement under Prime Minister Tony Blair about a decade and a half ago that has held between the Protestant majority, the Unionists, and a very violent radical wing of the Irish Republican Army that for about 30 years was wreaking great havoc, not just in Northern Ireland, but in Britain as well.
And there's a lot of concern that changes to the border might bring that back, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's extremely important that the open border between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland, thank you for making the point, remain open. And the Brexit agreement does include a rather complicated special provision to guarantee that in specific terms over the long term and with a declaration of good over the short term and with a declaration of goodwill over the long term. That's an extremely important point. And finally, the British have agreed to a payment, I think, of about 39 billion British pounds, about 50 billion U.S. dollars, to take care of financial obligations they've already incurred to the EU. So it's complicated. It is a realistic agreement. It's a great testament to the Prime Minister's determination.
Well, to say that the plan was not universally loved, however, would be maybe an understatement. It sounds as though it was trying to be all things to all people, and there are critics on both sides that say it was no things to no people. But this sounds like the trouble you have with a very simple question that has a very complicated answer.
Yeah, and rightly or wrongly, the Conservative government, since she took over last year, has been committed to ending the existing relationship with the EU. That's a result of a referendum that Prime Minister David Cameron held in 2016. The referendum resulted in a very narrow majority voting in favor of leaving the EU. She held a snap election in 2017 that removed the narrow conservative majority. They're now a minority government. And there's no indication that there's a majority of MPs in the House of Commons willing to support this new agreement. So she still labors mightily to try to survive as well as to get this through.
Labors being maybe a good use of words here.
But they're against it. The Liberal right. Democrats are against it. And the Democratic Unionist Party, the right-wing Ulster, Northern Ireland Party, which the Conservatives need to get a bare majority in Parliament, they're against it. We'll see. She has shown a lot of rigidity in this process, and for that reason, especially, her days, despite her determination, may be numbered.
Well, and so Britain is scheduled to leave the European Union in March of next year. What happens if Parliament doesn't approve this plan that the Prime Minister has proposed?
I don't know what will happen, and no one else does either, but the British do have a tendency to kind of work things out pragmatically, which is often referred to as muddling through. On March 29, 2019, they're scheduled to leave the EU, and there's a lot of very emotional commentary about crashing out of the EU, both in political circles and in the media at large. I don't think that will happen. I think it's possible they will have a second referendum, which I believe would be the sensible move, and that a majority of the British public this time around will decide, listen, it's much better off instead of this mess to simply stay in the EU.
Well, and even if her deal is approved, it sets the date for 2020 when by the time the entire deal will go into effect, with a possibility that it could go even longer than that.
Yeah, you've obviously done your homework. Thank you very much. It's a complicated deal, but it's also rather open-ended. Again, there are trade and financial realities that both sides recognize and therefore want to keep the country in the EU, whatever the emotional and ideological desire on the part of conservatives to get out.
Perhaps a reality check in this for other countries and other movements seeking to leave the EU.
Quite right. Yes, I think it the overall very good point. I wish I'd made that point, Mitch. The overall result may be to convince everybody that it's much better to hang together, to paraphrase Ben Franklin, rather than hanging separately or becoming even more diffuse. She is increasingly isolated, in great contrast to Angela Merkel, who's had a long run as Chancellor of Germany, or Nancy Pelosi, for that matter, in this country, who's about to become apparently Speaker yet again of the U.S. House of Representatives. She doesn't have that ruthless capacity to undercut threats to her position over a long period of time.
Let's shift now to our own borders. U.S. forces have used tear gas on migrants attempting to seek asylum along the Mexican border. Aside from the humanitarian issues this situation raises, what's the fallout for U.S.-Mexican relations?
I think that, again, our economic relationship is so close and our geographic proximity is so undeniable that Mexico will be an important partner of the U.S., albeit not as close in fundamental terms, historically or currently, as Canada. But I do believe that NAFTA will survive and U.S.-Mexico rapport will continue. It is a political opportunity for the president, President Trump, which he seized upon naturally, and the violence is most unfortunate. I'm very sorry that the president, understandable politically, but I'm very sorry the president has chosen to send some federal troops down to the border. I'm sure it'll reinforce his strong support with his base, but you're inconveniencing an awful lot of dedicated women and men who are in our armed forces, including over the holiday period. Not just the few thousand who are there, but the many thousands who serve in support of any U.S. military operation.
And, of course, Mexico is about to inaugurate a new president who has cast himself over a long political career as a champion and defender of the poor.
Yeah.
This becomes a thorny situation for him the moment he takes office.
Absolutely, a major challenge for him, but who knows, maybe the two populists will make music together. It's in the interest of both, I think, to get along. The basic fact that Americans should keep in mind, as tragic as some elements of the situation are, people want to get into the United States. We don't have to build walls to keep our people in. This is a country where many millions of people desire, indeed long, to live. And Americans should take some basic pride in that, however messy or chaotic our political and media commentaries.
Well, and there's a lot of talk about why Mexico needs the U.S., this giant economic force along their border. But why you know, what is in it for us? Why do we need Mexico? And why is any, you know, work that we do economically with this large country to the south so important to the United States?
They're an important source of raw materials for the United States, increasingly finished products, labor for the United States. Also, Mexico, like other developing countries, are becoming more and more developed, and the market for our goods, and in particular our services, continues to grow significantly. It's undeniable at this point in the 21st century that protectionism is not a positive long-term policy for any country, including a large, great economy like the U.S. We need our trading partners, an undeniable lesson of the terrible events of the 20th century. There are also strategic and security considerations. Mexico, the more vexed our relationship is, the more attractive Mexico is for investment and perhaps alliance by China, other competitors of the United States, the European Union. If this might seem too academic or impractical to any listener, take a look at the history of German-Mexican relations, especially up to the Second World War. If relations are difficult with Mexico or France and Mexico during our Civil War, it's an opportunity whenever relations are bad for third countries, major powers, third powers who don't have our best interests in mind, to develop openings with Mexico. Friendly borders are essential for our security. I hope that's a clear point. I hadn't thought of it before the program, but now that you bring it up, it's an extremely important point.
If not for the U.S. relationship with Mexico, Mexico has the potential for a relationship with someone without our best interests at heart, you're saying.
Exactly. Yeah. I think China is the most obvious. But Russia, however overblown, in my view, constant speculation about Russians influencing the 2016 election. Vladimir Putin is a very ambitious man. The latest violent incident with Ukraine and a ship off Crimea highlights this point. The economy is literally a basket case, but despite that weakness, Vladimir Putin continues to make aggressive moves and very effective diplomatic moves, especially but not exclusively in the Middle East. And I'm sure they have ambitions to be more influential in Latin America.
And finally, we are just a few weeks past the 2018 midterm elections. How soon do you think it'll be before we start seeing TV commercials for the 2020 elections?
I think they probably already started. We live in nonstop, endless money, endless media, endless campaigning in the 24/7 news cycle. So it's good that there are institutions like public radio and public television which provide a serious, reflective cast on what's going on in the world.
Well, and it's great that we have news analysts to do the same thing.
Well, thank you, Mitch.
Thanks, Art.
Thank you, sir.
Art Sear is a professor of political economy and world business and director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He's also our regular foreign policy contributor.
A quick break now, and then an international story that has played out within one family in Milwaukee. We'll learn about the documentary about a Northwest Milwaukee Chinese restaurant when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM.
Back with more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Yen Ching Restaurant on Good Hope Road in Milwaukee's northwest side has been serving up Chinese-American dishes like chow mein and mushu beef for decades.
A few years ago, local film student and Chinese native himself, Yinan Wang, worked as a director for the family-run restaurant. He became interested in the family story, specifically its generational dynamics.
Wang directed and edited a documentary of the same name, which showed at the Milwaukee Film Festival. Yujin Wang is producer of Yen Ching and Yinan's wife. She explains to Lake Effect Mayan Silver what initially attracted them to the story.
The owner, Mr. Chen, he wanted his younger son to come back to his family to help the family business. But his younger son doesn't want to do this. They are so different. So maybe the contradictions between the father generation and the son generation is a really interesting thing. And also Chinese culture behind this is really interesting because the father, Mr. Chen, he wanted to have his family reunion or being together forever. But his son, he want to go away. So this contradiction is really interesting.
So he worked at this Yenshin restaurant. He knew about the family dynamics. How did it come about that he decided to make a movie about it?
Oh, yeah. Actually, at the very beginning, this was his project from class. So the class required them to have a small storytelling in the form of movie or in the form of the film. So he started working on his project, and at the very beginning, the documentary was only like 20 minutes. So after the 20 minutes, he talked to his professor, Dick Blau, and the professor suggested him to make a longer one because the culture behind this is so interesting. So they decided to expand the 20-minute story to a bigger one, to a larger one.
So you mentioned that the film goes into generational differences.
Mm-hmm.
What is the aspect of the story that makes it particularly Chinese?
Wow, maybe Chinese food. Yeah, that's part of it. And, you know, in Chinese culture, the family should be together. But in the United States, it's different. Everybody is like, they have their own freedom to go wherever they want. So I think maybe this is kind of the difference from our perspective.
Do you feel like Mr. Chen's son, the younger son who was going to college, do you think he was buying more into the Western culture rather than the Chinese culture?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think he has like more sense about the Western culture, want to be away from the family, want to start his own business, and doesn't want to inherit anything from the family.
So there's a scene in the film where the father admits that he would be okay with his son going striking out on his own in a different business or whatever if he was able to financially make it.
Yeah.
Do you think that level of pressure was difficult for the younger son?
I don't think so. I think the younger son, he is very ambitious and he believes he is able to run a business or be success. So I don't think this can be a pressure for him. It's just like he doesn't want to stay with his father. I think the biggest pressure is the pressure from his, from working with his father or working with his family. Yeah.
You mentioned that the food is particularly Chinese about this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Was there anything about the story that was particularly Chinese?
I think it's the spirit of his father. So in the movie, if you can see that, in the movie, the father, Mr. Chen, mentioned one very important concept in Chinese culture, which is a family should be together. So I think this is like the most important thing in the Chinese culture. Family should be together.
And was that something surprising when you came to the United States and that was not necessarily the way that all American families run their lives?
Well, yes and no. Yes, it's because, you guys are just like being away from home and do whatever, go wherever you guys want. No, it's because actually in China, a lot of younger generations or the younger families, they are accepting this kind of concept that a family doesn't have to be together forever. So it's more like half-half.
The tide is shifting in China, you would say?
Yeah.
And what was it like coming from China to Milwaukee in particular when you got here?
People are so into cheese.
That's right.
And a beer.
Cheese is not as big in Chinese cuisine at all, right?
Not at all. It's so different.
was there anything culturally interesting? Because, you know, Yancheng is, I mean, there are some Chinese restaurants in Milwaukee, but there's not a Chinatown. There's not a particular neighborhood where there's a big Chinese population.
Mm-hmm.
Did that surprise you? Like, what was that like dealing with that? Coming from China and then maybe having not such a strong Chinese presence in Milwaukee.
Yeah, I think when I moved to Milwaukee, I really didn't feel like a lot of Chinese people or Asian people here. But with like a couple of years living here, I figured out it's not that small community. So the Chinese community or the Asian community is just not that small. So I think it's growing or it's improving.
What was it like filming this film in terms of, you know, going to Yancheng and setting up filming and that type of thing? How did customers react to it?
Right. So it's kind of the trust building thing because it's, you know, the story is very private and it's a story about Chinese restaurants, so you have to like build the trust with the owner or with the character in the movie, in the film, and because my husband, we didn't have any fundings or any sponsors or anything. So everything he did or we did is just by ourselves. So including the editing, shooting or whatever. And it's really difficult. Yeah.
How did the Chens react to the movie when it was done?
At the very beginning, he was very like sensitive about it. He didn't like people shooting him in the movie. But with like building the trust with each other, he and his wife thought this may be a good opportunity for the public to know how their life is, and let the outside world listen to the Chinese community's voice and show them like what the life is behind their Chinese restaurant, because there are so many Chinese restaurants in the States. But you guys didn't know, like you guys don't know the stories or the culture behind it. So maybe it's a good opportunity to show them.
The Chens are immigrants to the United States.
Yep.
But yet it didn't seem like the film totally centered around the immigrant experience. It was mostly, it seemed like it was a more universal message about being working people and, like you said, keeping a family together. But there was one scene, and the movie opened up with a scene of the older son trying to change the menu of the restaurant.
Yep.
And he was having a hard time spelling menu and explaining it to the person who was on the phone. Mm-hmm. What did the role of being an immigrant play in the film?
Because they story want to focus more on Chen and his restaurant and the story of the family. So I think the immigrant's role in this film is like a contradiction, especially for the different generations contradiction. And it, as you can see, Chen's wife, she also doesn't speak English, right? She was like trying to learn ABCD. And his older son doesn't know how to spell the menu. So it's kind of hard for them to live in the States. However, they're still chasing their American dreams. So that's a funny part. That's the interesting part. Yeah.
Was there anything that surprised you about when you learned more about the story?
Well, when people are, the first thing is Chinese food is kind of different from Chinese American food. So that is one thing. But the second is when we are seeing someone like Mr. Chen and his family are running a business, we thought maybe they are rich or maybe they're just like living a really, really good life. However, the reality is so different. They have to work very, very hard to keep their life. So this is something that surprised me. Yeah. From the surface, it's something. But under the surface, it's a totally different thing. Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming and speaking about the film.
Sure. Thank you.
Yujin Wang produced the documentary Yen Qing that showed at the Milwaukee Film Festival. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mayan Silver.
One more break, and then we'll talk with Milwaukee poet John Cady about a new collection of work gathered over 50 years of writing poems. This is Lake Effect for Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. John Cady has been writing poems for more than a half century. He's earned awards and national renown, including the Lenore Marshall Poetry Prize and the Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award. But here in Milwaukee, he might be better known for his years of service to philosophy as a professor and now distinguished professor emeritus at UW-Milwaukee.
Aficionados of all of his work will gather Friday evening at Boswell Book Company to hear Cady read from his new collection of poems, Walking Backwards, Poems 1966 to 2016. He shared a couple when he joined us for a conversation recently. John Cady, welcome back to the program.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I always enjoy this.
There is a poem that starts off this collection that is more recent, I think, than the others in the collection. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little about it and then and read it for us.
Yes, it's a poem called English 206, and I wrote it after the book had been put together, the poems had been compiled. And it the title refers to a course I took my sophomore year at Princeton in 1965, where I first read modern poetry. I'd been intent on becoming a theoretical physicist, though I read a lot of modernist fiction in high school. But once I started college, my interests changed, and I finally read modern poetry in this course, and it just dazzled me, and I didn't quite understand what it was, but I knew I wanted to try to do that too, whatever it turned out to be. So I wrote this poem after I'd put the book together, which looks back on that. It's called English 206. It was actually taught by Carlos Baker, who was Ernest Hemingway's first biographer, and I guess quite an important figure at the time. English 206. Why would anyone even want to do it anymore? 52 years ago, I didn't know what it was, and yet I knew I wanted to do it too. Like the idea of a mind the self aspires to, the self a mind endeavors to become. I still don't and still do. Yeats and Frost, Pound and Eliot, Stevens, Moore, seen as from a peak in Darien in a college course with a syllabus, lectures twice a week, a final exam. It might not sound transformative, but in an incidental way, what I am now, what I'll die as, and how I'll linger on for the small while that constitutes an afterlife, was there from the first day. The urgency, the anxiety, the sense of something insisting to be said again before the mystery and necessity drifted away. It looks different now. What's become of poetry are different kinds of poets, i.e., different kinds of people, having nothing much in common but the name. I miss the echo chamber, where you studied to become something unforeseen, recognizable in retrospect. I miss the mystery, the feeling of history gradually unfolding, and the way it made no sense at all until it did. In the afternoon of the author, everything is there to see. No one told me when I was starting out, that day so long ago, that things become more and more familiar. Then suddenly you're old, with nothing to do and nothing stretching out before you to infinity, reducing whatever you did or had to say to a footnote, skipped over in the changing afternoon light, that finally becomes, at best, part of the narrative in a MoMA of the mind. But I'm glad I did it anyway.
John Cady reading English 206, the poem that opens his collection, Walking Backwards. First of all, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
What was it in that classroom in Princeton in 1965 that so radically changed your thinking about what you wanted to do with your life?
Well, I'd around the same time I was switching from physics and math to philosophy, so it was and then I also decided to start writing poetry. I stopped running track and started smoking, so it was a kind of complete collapse into decadence. But there was just something, as I said, I'd had an interest in modernist fiction, but I'd never read modernist poetry. And there just seemed to be something about the work of people like T.S. Eliot that had a kind of ambition and way of seeing something about life and experience that I couldn't imagine grasping otherwise, and I just became driven to try to emulate that. And I think in retrospect it really was the kind of intellectual ambition of the enterprise that struck me so powerfully. And poetry, of course, has changed a lot since then, and I think that's one thing that's become less prominent in it, but it certainly was central to it back there in 1965.
Well, what do you think, Poe? You mentioned, you say this in the poem you just read. What has changed about poetry today?
Well, just mechanically. I mean, when I was starting out, there was no writing program. And there were a few in the country, in Iowa, Columbia, maybe Johns Hopkins, I'm not sure. But it's become such an industry now that I think most of the poets I knew, and there were a lot of serious undergraduate poets, and we all hung out together and taught each other, really. But poets tended to be inspired by other poets that they first read and thought of as great in some sense and wanted to emulate them. I mean, there were a lot of divisions in the poetry world. There was a kind of mainstream, and then there were various alternatives to it, contained, say, in Donald Allen's New American Poetry, a kind of counter to the mainstream anthology. But I think wherever you stood on that, and I was very much anti-mainstream when I started out, you aspired to, I mean, it sounds corny, but you thought of the poets that inspired you as having achieved a kind of greatness that you wanted to emulate. And I think there certainly are as many gifted and talented poets, if not more, now than there were then. But I think there is no mainstream anymore, and it's really become more a kind of career that you set to, a career with benefits that you aspire to. Whereas no one I knew really ever thought of making a living out of writing poetry. It was something they wanted to do for its own sake. So it's not as though these developments are good or bad, but they just sort of color one's outlook towards it, and it seems to have changed.
Well, one imagines that there have been times throughout the years that that musicians and composers have thought the same thing about.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think, I mean, those days were, at least as far as popular music goes, there's a kind of evolution from that as a form of, guitar heroism to a kind of commodification of it. So it's not peculiar to poetry, but poetry is more marginalized than it was then. It wasn't uncommon for famous poets to be on the cover of Life magazine or something then. It was central to the culture in a way it simply isn't anymore. I mean, T.S. Eliot, I think, read to a crowd of 16,000 people at the University of Minnesota, something that just seems inconceivable now.
Inconceivable, but delicious.
Yes, yes.
What was the process of going through all of these old works? Do you think of this as the narrative arc of your poetry life?
Yes, in a way, yes. There have been a couple of shifts in it. When I first started out, my first model was people like T.S. Eliot, and then I became taken with the Black Mountain poets like Robert Duncan. But really, my career is, as it turned out, began when I discovered the New York School poets like John Ashbery and Frank O'Hara, and younger ones too, like Peter Sheldahl, who's now the art critic for The New Yorker. And when I first started writing in my present form, I really thought of myself as a kind of New York School poets and trying to emulate and be part of that world. College was very close to New York, so I knew a lot of those figures. And that was fine for a while, and the first selections in this book are from a book called Blue Vents, published in 1968. And I wanted to make those selections. They're just six poems, but they're entirely poems I wrote in college. A couple of years after that, around 1969, I think it was, I just began to find this whole idea of thinking of myself as a New York School poet very confining and kind of annoying, because one thing that goes with being part of a school is that you exclude things that aren't. And I just found I didn't want to be constrained in that way. So I started writing long, more lyrical, maybe more ambitious poems, and that seemed to go pretty well. And I stuck with that for quite a while. And then I think I finally, starting in the mid-80s, I lost my sense of being influenced by the poets who were still great heroes of mine, like John Ashbery and James Schuyler and others. And then I wrote a very long autobiographical poem called Falling Water, which was the first, that was in 1991, first autobiographical poem I'd really written. And then in the 2000s, I started writing what I think of as memory poems. Proust has always been one of my big influences, and I found the idea of just having a kind of Proustian recollection of some past event that's not particularly significant in itself was kind of a way of coming to terms with the passage of time, and that marked another shift in the evolution of my work. So
I thought that line in the poem you read about that, then suddenly you're old, was a particularly Proustian sounding sentiment.
Yes, though he didn't actually make it to be very old.
Yeah, it's true.
Yes, but it is. I mean, the passage of time has always been probably the central subject of my poetry in all of its phases. But there are just different ways of trying to write about time, and I found this kind of recollective way to be something I've continued to do, though not exclusively. So in selecting the poems, I tried to reflect some of those changes in the way I thought of my work.
You know, this almost seems like a pedestrian question, but there had to be so many more poems out there that didn't make the cut in putting this collection together. How did you know you were done? How did you know this was the right group?
Well, let's see. I did have a previous new and selected poems in 2002, so I started off with those selections, and I modified them. I could have done it. I'm sure the FSG would have done a collected poems if I'd wanted, but I didn't want that. For one thing, I thought it would be too long. There were a lot of poems in my first two or two and a half books that I really don't stand by, and I didn't want to republish those. I think at one period I kind of have a reputation as a very abstract poet, and while that's certainly true of some of my work, I think that's somewhat exaggerated. So I wanted to make the selections with an eye to variety. Also, there are poems of mine which I like individually, but which kind of resemble each other a little bit. So I wanted to, you know, try to minimize those resemblances. And I guess those were the principles that guided me. I wanted it to come in, you know, I didn't want it to go over 400 pages, so I had that in mind too.
As you say, there are a selection of poems that you wrote while you were still in college.
Yes.
And it strikes me that if you can look back after, you know, 50 years at things that you wrote in college and be pretty comfortable with it, you've done something right with your life.
Well, I suppose, and in a way, I think of the book seems to me to be centered on college. I mean, that's when I started writing. The title poem, Walking Backwards, is what that refers to are those tours that prospective students take in April at colleges where someone is trying to convince them to come and talks to them walking backwards while he's talking. So it does seem to, I mean, college sort of seems to be a central part of my work. I'm not quite sure why. And that's why I chose the cover, since I associate college with foliage, and I didn't want a literally collegiate cover, but I like the photograph of Tom Bamberger's photograph of this foliage. So yeah, I'm not sure why I find associate poetry with college, other than the obvious fact that that's when I started writing.
I wonder if to close you might be willing to read Selfie Stick.
Oh sure, this poem was, I think that's the next to the last poem in the book. It was written in Paris when we were there at Thanksgiving, 2 years ago? And there were all these tourists with taking pictures of themselves on selfie sticks.
And just amazing to think that, you know, how far we've, you know, the idea of a selfie stick in 1965 or even 1985 would just be absurd.
Yes, it certainly would be. It's pretty absurd right now.
Exactly. Maybe no less absurd today.
Okay. Selfie stick. To snap yourself from half a life away, with the city of lights floating in the background and a smile frozen on the same face you wore on a day in 1985 in the garden of Hotel de Marigny, the hotel we're staying in now. On a day. What used to be a real time in an actual place isn't real anymore, although the person that I'd been is still real, and the eternal present I inhabit remains real too. At least for now. What holds it together is internal to it, like the music of the mirror that arises out of nowhere and continues forever, through the vagaries of adolescence and middle age and the fear of gradually getting old, until it ends abruptly, for no reason, on a random afternoon, the way a Patricia Highsmith character might die, in a freak fall on a nondescript street thousands of miles from home. It didn't happen, but something like it will in time, and then time ends. Life seems necessary from the inside, but from the outside it's contingent and terrifying, with the precariousness of existence written on its face. I keep waiting for the thing to happen, meanwhile holding it at arm's length, keeping it at bay.
John Cady, thank you so much, and come back and see us.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure, Mitch.
John Cady's new book is called Walking Backwards, Poems 1966 to 2016, and it's just out. He'll read from it and talk more Friday evening at Boswell Book Company.
Finally today, we have time for a song recorded recently in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. Hanukkah starts at sundown on Sunday, not long after the fifth candle is lit. Milwaukee musicians Mitch Shiner, Rick Aaron, Joey Sanchez, Dave Bayless, and Cecilio Negron Jr. will mix the flavors of Latin jazz and Hanukkah classics.
Their concert is called Latka con Salsa. We'll have a full interview with them next week, but here's a taste of their performance, a song called Se Vivan, Sav Sav Sav.
Thank you.
That's Sevivan Sov Sov Sov, recorded in the Lake Effect Performance Studio with Mitch Shiner on vibes, Rick Aaron on flute, Joey Sanchez on bass, and Cecilio Negron Jr. on congas. Their concert, Latke con Salsa, is scheduled for next Thursday evening at Jewish Community Center Milwaukee. We'll have a full interview next week, and you can find more information at WUWM.com. That's all for Wednesday's edition of the program. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Fact here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.